Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I have Nicola Sinclair. Nicola is the founder and general partner of Twin Track Ventures. In today's episode, we talk about why the military, or how the military, has moved from 8 people using one laptop in the dark ages of the defense services to where we are today.
It was like one laptop between 8 people. So, you know, when my boss at the time was like, I've got to go to this conference, I've got a 200-page paper folder, can I have the departmental laptop? I'm like, no, someone else has got it. Like, it was hilarious, but also so depressing.
What do you do when you get sent a drone with a gun on it, and how do you use it elsewhere?
I often get sent something like that looks like a drone and a gun stuck together, right? And I said to him, okay, I can see how that might be useful in the military context, like, how does that work in security?
How printing aircraft parts at the point of use is bringing time to repair down by weeks. How countries have different priorities and how to leverage interoperability whilst maintaining a point of difference. The role of science within defence. How we can reconnect disconnected communities. How AUKUS is impacting emerging technologies. And whether or not we've reached peak drone. Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I have Nicola Sinclair. Nicola is the founder and general partner of Twin Track Ventures, a dual-use venture capital firm based in London, backing founders, raising pre-seed and seed rounds with a focus on teams building deep tech solutions for critical challenges. Prior to founding Twin Track, Nicola was fund manager of the Air Innovation Fund, having spent close to two decades as a military officer in the Royal Air Force. Nicola, really wonderful to have you here. It's been, I think, quite a long time coming. We've been dancing around getting you on for quite a while now.
Wow, yeah, it's great to be here today. Looking forward to chatting.
Amazing. Well, look, let's dive straight in. I think it's become quite clear over the last several years how important innovation in defense is. However, when you first joined the military, straight out of university, you couldn't just email someone in the army. You would have to figure out their email based on a variety of factors, right? So I've interviewed a few people who've had experience in the IDF in Israel, where it would seem that there's a strong culture of technological innovation. How would you describe the UK's evolution regarding innovation in defence from when you first joined to when you ultimately left, having pitched and successfully commissioned and run the Air Innovation Fund in the early 2020s?
Yeah, so that 20-year period was quite a wild ride. Like, when I first joined, we had these things called like a memo pad. It was literally like a notepad filled out in a certain format, and that's how you would send somebody a message, like with a pen and a piece of paper, and you'd put it like in the mail.
There was
a lesson. We had to sit through a half-hour lesson. Like, everyone was falling asleep because you're just like, been running around on a assault course, how to fill out like a particular type of envelope, how to like post this letter around. And that was fine if you were like on a base, yeah, right? But it was no good if you needed to message somebody like at another station. You know, they might be kind of 3, 4, 5 hours drive away. You couldn't just like go and see this person.
Yeah.
And you had a completely independent email. Like, you'd have to telephone them, get their email, send it over. And then you couldn't even like message somebody who's like in a different service. Like, today, all of that's just been taken care of.
As in,
like,
the RAF could not message, the army could not message the Navy.
Yeah, you could if you knew that person's email, but you couldn't just like search for it.
There wasn't a Nicola.Sinclair at RAF.com.
No. You had to like meet that person. Like, to be honest, in the very early days, when Facebook got created, it was amazing because you could find somebody like by name, and there was like a particular number. If you could get that particular number off them, you could kind of recreate the email address. Yeah. So that was horrendous. And we've come like a massively long way in that time, right? Like, that is very, very like dated. Things aren't like that anymore. But it's really illustrative of just like how defense like actually really lags behind the rest of the real world. So take COVID, for example. When we went into COVID, we had like a departmental laptop. There was like one laptop between 8 people. And so, you know, I remember my boss at the time was like, I've got to go to this conference, I've got a 200-page paper folder, can I have the departmental laptop? I'm like, no, someone else has got it. Like, it was hilarious, but also so depressing. So a lot of that has come a really long way. And I think a big part of it has been a change in the tech scene, also in the UK. So people have understood that things can move quickly, that defence primes are not your only source of technology. Yeah. And I think also the defence system has really started to understand the difference between new technology that needs adoption and tech that is innovative tech, right? That is actually really changing how people can operate and how can people have more effect, especially as like the number of people have gone down. So when I first joined the Air Force, it was twice the size that it is today, right? So more with less is like a reoccurring theme. The answer is always technology. I think personally technology is like an accelerant in whichever direction your company is going in, right? Like if you're on a downwards trajectory, tech can kind of take you there faster. If you're on like an upwards trajectory, it can take you there faster. So new structures have been created, more money has been put into it. A lot of change has happened in like how you can contract those companies.
Yeah.
But this is really early days, right? Like this is the beginning of a change rather than like the culmination of where we want to be.
Even today you're saying it's early days.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right.
Okay. So it's taken 20 years to get here.
Yeah.
And we're just at the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's true.
Amazing. And I mean, I guess, so I kind of understand why some of those structures may have been in place from a security perspective, right? So obviously you don't want, you know, people to be accessible by the outside world, like, you know, very easily, like within the Defence Force. You want to ensure that there is appropriate security and, I guess, some Chinese walls between certain departments. And obviously decisions have to go down the right chain of command and so on. But presumably what that would have meant is that, you know, to your point, if it takes 5 hours to get a message from A to B, if you have critical kind of requirements, how would those be dealt with? I mean, how could you move fast in, you know, presumably defense being a fast moving, you know, if you are in the theater, as it were, like things have to happen in nanoseconds or, you know, very short periods of time in terms of decision making. So how would information flow effectively, or was it just not effective?
I mean, I think what you're really starting to get is that people have changed the way they work in that time. And a lot of it's to do with collaboration. Yeah. So before, the Air Force would like work with the Air Force, the Army would work with the Army. And if you needed to do something together, you would physically travel somewhere. And you've probably seen paintings and so on of like people in different uniforms standing around a table with a big map on it, pointing at the map.
Yeah. With those things that move the little figurines across the map. Yeah.
You know, for the time, they did some amazing things. Like there's no doubting some of the sort of effort and outcomes from that very basic level of technology have been hugely fundamental to, you know, the democracy we enjoy today. But especially with a smaller force, especially where people are trying to do more work, you're losing hours traveling. Like that doesn't make sense when you could pick up a phone and have a video call. So I think there is an acceptance that collaboration is really important and sharing different skill sets between different services is super important, but also between different countries, right? Like we don't often do much as the UK, or certainly in my lifetime, as somebody who was kind of being born around the time of the Falklands, right? Like we haven't really done much as the UK on its own. So tech is super important in making those things seamless, efficient, and getting like the right answer to the question, or even just asking the right question is generally a good start in those sorts of situations where there's like a super high level of uncertainty.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with real world, right? This isn't a policy that's going to have a lag and you can see like an outcome in a couple of years and course correct. A lot of what happens in defense is quite fast. Yeah. And you're dealing with like a here and now issue that has like a threat to life, be it of the forces that you're looking after or planning for, or like people in a country that you're trying to help or in that region. So a lot's been put in place to really try and drive that forward. I think the innovation community that's grown in defence is now trying to say, we don't have to settle for that. Like, we don't have to cope with Excel spreadsheets and like Outlook. You know, there are really interesting tools out there that can not take the decision away from a human, but can like boost the insight the human making the decision has.
Yeah.
How do you aggregate all this data? How do you bring the most important data up to the top of the pile and let that human then weigh up, like the risk-reward balance, right? How do you support those really important decisions? And that tech doesn't often come from a prime, right? Like primes play a hugely important role in the ecosystem, but that's when you're generally trying to build maybe like a fighter jet, right? Like the primes are not maybe going to give you some of the decision support tools you might need to, for example, use AI to sift like a huge volume of data. So I think there's a role for those primes to continue, but a lot of this is to do with how do you work with startups? How do you make it clear if they're building a solution for one reason, like, and it has another application, how do you make that need clear? Like, how do you find that synergy? And then how do you bring everything together into like a coherent picture? So that's really early on. Like that work of trying to make everything kind of fit together from different providers is super, super early.
Well, I mean, that raises in my head like three or four questions, right? Like, so let's try and tackle them, right? So part of this is exactly what you're doing at TwinTrack. So one of the questions I had was, you know, are these technologies that are now being implemented defense specific, or are you able to use technologies that have been built for other purposes and actually either, you know, either they work very specifically within the, you know, framework of the defense services or the military services, or does something have to be built, you know, very specifically? And like the kind of example, I guess, that comes to mind is I remember the kind of BlackBerry days where, you know, essentially most corporates would not move away from BlackBerrys because of the, you know, they were the tool of business because of the encryption systems and the messaging and so on and so forth. They were, you know, they were embedded almost, right? And it took quite a long time, I think, from memory for companies to shift over to using, you know, be it Apple devices or Android devices or whatever. So I guess question one, you know, how many of these technologies were built for defense versus were built, you know, with other applications in mind that have then actually shown to have been valuable within defense? And I'm sure there are, I mean, email is an obvious example. Email, it doesn't really matter whether it was built for defense or not. There might be some encryption standards that need to be, you know, need to be boosted. But for the most part, the actual kind of process of how an email works is going to be the same irrespective. That's sort of the first question. The second thing that came up from what you just said there, and you and I were talking about this just before, is this idea of defense isn't only a national endeavor, it is an international endeavor. And obviously in a world where, you know, we are seeing certainly some friction, right, on the international stage, we're obviously seeing, really, really bad outcomes, obviously in, you know, Ukraine, in the Middle East, with actual, you know, wars and elsewhere in Sudan and other regions. But a lot of nation states, I'm not necessarily talking about the UK specifically here, but a lot of nation states have gone down a sort of more nationalistic attitude. The guy whose name I'm not allowed to mention on the podcast because YouTube then sort of shuts us down. But, you know, the guy who maybe might be doing some stuff in the US in the future, you know, is quite an advocate of stripping down things like NATO and, you know, and so on and so forth. You know, how has that kind of international cooperation maybe shifted a little bit? And within that framework, you know, we're recording this a couple of weeks before the UK elections in 2024. It feels like, you know, the major parties have committed to, you know, increasing defense spend to 2.5%, I think, of GDP. How does that then play into both the, you know, the international aspect as well as what that means for I guess, the ability to investigate and adopt more innovative sort of technologies and strategies? I know that was quite a broad, those are two
quite
broad.
Yeah, you have to keep me on track. But I think the first question is like super clear. So what TwinTrack looks for is dual use technologies. They are commercial technologies. They can serve commercial customers. But they can also be really impactful in national security. They're quite hard to define because, like, for example, take a drone. I often get sent something like that looks like a drone and a gun stuck together, right? And I say to him, okay, I can see how that might be useful in a military context. Like, how does that work in security? How does that work in, like, a commercial environment? And they say, oh, it can be used for, like, livestock vaccination. I'm like, okay, really interesting, but what does that market look like? And why would it need this, like, drone-gun combo, right? Like, is it necessary? So some of this space is slightly corrupted by technologies that are really defense that have like a kind of fig leaf of dual use application stock on there. That is not where this should stay, right? Like the point is, and I'll take one of the companies I've worked with before, they make a 3D printer that can work with ultra hard metals and ceramics. They can make hip and knee replacement joints that have better patient outcomes.
Yeah.
If you're a commercial producer of those parts, you can double the output from your factory. That's really meaningful. What they can do in defense is because of the way the printer operates, as it's producing the part doesn't cool down, which means that you can take their printer and put it somewhere, for example, like a building of opportunity in a remote location, and you can print aircraft parts at the point of use. And you can print them for the UK, for the Americans, for whoever else is using that same base. And you can save weeks of broken aircraft time So in my lifetime, I've spent a long time sitting at the side of an airfield waiting for an aircraft to be fixed. And something like that is really meaningful, right? It's not at the front end of military operations.
Yeah.
It supports a military that is more robust, more resilient, can do more, but it's not like a drone and a gun glued together. So that's a great, to me, a great example of like the sort of dual use functionality that I think should be existing, yeah. LP should back, that TwinTrack looks for, right?
Yeah. Like, so it's not even just about the product that they output, it's the technology that they're using, and therefore can that be repurposed
right.
like elsewhere as well?
What's the point, right? Yeah, like, yeah. The point is I can produce these things and save myself weeks of time. I'm not saving any money, but the aircraft is functional and that saves me something else. So that's a good example of like really what we now want to see in the dual use space. These things are usually created for a commercial need, and then there's an application you see in the defense space. It can work the other way around much less frequently. Like, there's a great outcome as well at the other end of this. It solves some of the problems you've seen with defense companies saying like government needs to procure more. Like, it's not up to government to build your business for you. Like, you need to be selling. Yeah, and if you're totally
reliant on
government customers, like, I think that's a model that I personally wouldn't want to back and wouldn't want my LPs to back.
But there's a massive risk, right?
Like, it's bigger risk.
And if government changes, or if, you know, a civil servant, you know, in charge of the decision making moves somewhere else and has a relationship.
It's fragile. Yeah, it's fragile. Exits, what do you look at for exits? Well, you're basically looking at a relatively small number of primes, or you're looking to become a prime and IPO. So in the dual use model, it's slightly different because you could potentially, in the example I've given, somebody in the healthcare space could acquire you, or somebody in the sort of defense space could acquire you. That's very interesting for me as a fund manager. So it's baked into the model. It's baked in for several different reasons. There is this core belief that's the right way of doing things, but it also, I think, is helpful when you're looking at the outcome for that VC fund. VC funds aren't charities, you know, yep. like productivity engines. It's good to be doing something worthwhile, but you need an outcome, right? Otherwise, you're not going to exist and your fund is not going to exist in the future. So to your other question then, which I think was really centered around what does this look like as partnership?
Yeah, right? International plus.
Yeah. You know, spoke earlier about how the UK doesn't do a lot on its own. I spent some time in NATO headquarters, like planning very large scale multinational operations where sort of the policy touched the actual doing level. Mm-hmm. And the way a lot of that works is somebody, often the US, volunteers to be a framework nation, and they set out like a basic capability. Other nations then plug in with something really special that really like adds to everybody's ability to operate in that area and make a difference, whatever the mission is. So what's interesting, I think, in this tech space is that countries have different priorities and that can come together for those aligned democratic nations in a really powerful way. Like, you don't want to have this like homogeneity. You don't want all of the armed forces to look the same. Like, there is a core level of what we call interoperability, whether that's in terms of how we do things or whether that's in terms of what we have, like the physical equipment working together. But there's this idea also of a point of difference being really meaningful. And so was it like for the UK, for example, with the famous Chinook helicopter, like it can lift a lot of stuff, it can lift a lot of people. It can be really meaningful in everything from bringing troops into an area through to disaster relief, right? Like, the military has quite a broad remit. And I think that's really important here. Like, not all of these technologies are attack technologies. Personally, TwinTrack is much more on the side of like foundational technologies and things that really fit into the idea of defense. Like, it's called defense for a reason. And I think, you know, in the Western world, a lot of people have lost contact. A lot of nations don't have things like national service. Like, I went through the military. That was a personal choice. To me, it makes a lot more sense when you've chosen to be there.
I had very big arguments with my daughters about this 2 weeks ago, but yeah, okay.
And I'm not somebody I necessarily really wish to give a view, knowing the reality of what that mean for young people in the UK. I'm not sure that I would see that as something that everybody had to be sort of forced to
into
do.
It, yeah.
I think there's different ways of serving your country that isn't necessarily like the military. Different types of service, right? But I think that when you're in an environment where people haven't had the exposure because they haven't had a brother or a sister or a cousin, you're relatively removed from it. And I think that a lot of people saw maybe things like flood relief and they saw the military getting involved in that, but they didn't day to day really understand what it meant to be in the military or kind of the purpose of having one. And I think in that context, you could say, well, do we really need it anymore? Like, we live in quite a stable world. And I think this is
do we? Like, really? Is that
right? I think we do day to day. Like, day to day, I don't think I need to see the UK military on the streets of the UK.
Sure.
But that's obviously different in other parts of the world. So I think it's there because the construct of defence and deterrence exists. And I think if you take away funding from the military, you stop investing in it. I do think there's a real threat that of increased instability, right? Like, I think that maybe for like a different generation, like those watchers on the wall, that kind of Game of Thrones analogy, right? They're there for a reason and they provide a platform.
Yeah.
that's peaceful and stable, and people can deal with things like education. They can try and deal with other, like,
because they're not
like
constantly looking
change.
Over their shoulders.
I mean, let's look at some countries that have been super unstable. Like, how much do people in that area really manage to move forward issues like health, education, climate change? Like, if your country's at war, it's really hard to get someone to care about, like, carbon, right? Like, it's really meaningful in terms of giving a stable platform for other arguably bigger issues, right? Like, I would like to not care about defence, but I think it's the sort of foundational level that allows you then to get other items onto the agenda.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're going to move on to kind of that question a bit more depth now as well. But one of the things I think I've talked about this on previous podcasts. In fact, very recently we had Luba and David from Blue Lake, which supports migrant founders in the UK, but they are both from Ukraine. And we talked a lot, obviously, about what's happening in Ukraine at the moment and what's been happening in terms of founders, obviously, building defense tech on the ground for deployment immediately, obviously, dealing with what's happening there, which is, you know, unconscionable. But the point is, I think that obviously, defense is there for when you don't need it, right? Like, sort of thing. It's kind of like, you hope you don't ever need it, but, you know, you may well need it, and therefore you need to be prepared for it. And one of the things that I talked about was I did a podcast with Theo Priestley about, what the future should have looked like, right? And I was talking about when I was growing up, what did I expect of the future in technology, and, you know, I was talking about, I still remember, you know, watching Airwolf, right? As example.
Cool, yeah.
loved, like, it was my favorite program, right? Right.
Yeah.
But like Airwolf and Kit in Knight Rider and all this sort of stuff. And obviously what we've ended up with is,
oh my God,
is,
I'm still hoping for a Kit.
We got the Tesla, but, you know,
it's not
quite there yet. No. Right. But one of the things that I said, cause he posed a question, goes, well, what do you think, why do you think we aren't where you thought we would have been 30 years ago? Right. And actually, when I scratched my head, the thought that came to my mind was, so much of technology that we use on a day-to-day basis, be it the internet, be it GPS, right, was developed within military settings. And one of the reasons I think that we haven't necessarily seen that sort of innovation, even if you look at what Elon's doing with SpaceX versus NASA, et cetera, is because there has not been sort of, you know, to put it crudely, an arms race. There hasn't been that kind of hostility amongst large nation states. Maybe there's been a bit of a step back from military spending, which has maybe throttled innovation to some extent, right? Like, if you were in the midst of having to figure out, well, you know, is this country an aggressor or not or whatever, and having to prepare for that, would we have actually innovated more, I guess, is the question that I posed. I don't know that there is an obvious answer to that. I don't even know if I'm
I have a
right
view
on
that.
Yeah.
So I think if you think of it as a circle, right, like you have outside founders, they have an idea. For me, deep tech, it's very science-driven.
Yeah.
You create it into business. You see if there's a role in defense. Maybe defense buys it. You know, there's a kind of circle there. But the sort of top part of it's missing, which is defense adapts as a result of taking that technology in. There are a lot of scientists actually inside defense, particularly in the capability areas, which look at like how the future Air Force, Navy, whatever, are going to operate. They create quite a lot of IP, but we're not great on bringing that IP out anymore.
The commercialization.
Right,
of,
the commercialization. Yeah. So the entities, for example, like Plowshare, if it's not familiar to you, like we can maybe put it a link or something, I don't know.
But yeah, sure.
They exist, and that is in part their role, but they've been, they're quite small, and they've been active, but active at a certain scale, right? So some things have come out. For example, there's an interesting company that uses some of their IP to really improve sepsis diagnosis. Like, that's really meaningful for everybody outside of, you know, defense. You don't need to be in defense to benefit from that technology. But what they've been able to bring out is relatively limited for a number of constraining reasons. So I think there's something there around like IP that's inside the system that has not come out in the way that, you know, you've just described with some really game-changing large-scale technologies.
Yeah, which I think is probably quite similar to the arguments around university spin-outs and so on and so forth. So, I mean, yeah, look, I mean, the defense sector, exactly to this point, right, also touches on multiple facets of life outside of the obvious, even thinking about logistics and supply chain and how that impacts on issues around, say, climate change, I think you mentioned as well. So how do you think about those things holistically, right? Because to your point, like if they're not being commercialized, and they're not coming out, how does one develop those? And not only that, but dual purpose is the whole basis of Twin Tracks thesis. So explain why it's so important to look at those applications both inside and as well as outside the military. Because, like, to your point, yes, you know, sepsis diagnosis, or, you know, printing of you know, parts for you know, for hip and knee joint replacements, etc. That's all kind of quite obvious. But I would imagine it's not immediately obvious when a technology has a dual purpose, right? So how do you kind of circle that square?
Yeah, well, a big part of it is disconnected communities, right? Like, people who sit in the science community inside defense have generally been there a really long time. You know, they enjoy their work, they enjoy the freedom they have to work on really interesting problems. It's not common for example, VC funds to get much time with people like that, right?
Yeah.
And whilst, as
they kind of stay in their lane, as in the scientists stay in their lane, and you don't know they exist.
Right, exactly. And there's not that much flow either between sort of that defence scientific world and potentially, you know, the founder community. So I think that that's at the very earliest stages of changing, but there are not many people who've certainly recently, like, worn a uniform and worked in this world of, like, how to support, financially support startups. So I see a big part of what I do as somebody who's got, like, 20 years of defense experience in understanding, like, the likely landing points for technology and saying, oh, I know, like, how would I have liked that as somebody who sat down and planned an operation? Like, what gap could I have filled and made something quicker or better? And part of it is talking to the founder about how they envisage their technology being used. Part of it is talking to the national security community about, like, what are the real problems? And I think that, you know, to be fair to the community, they're like a lot of customers. Nobody asked for an iPhone until they saw it, and then they were immediately addicted, right? So what I have seen on more than one occasion is those classic problems of there's no money, it's really difficult to work with defense security, like, it's very slow.
Yeah, we hear this
no
a
one
lot
makes
with
a decision.
We hear a lot of it around the NHS and education.
Yeah, like large
similar sort of, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big ship to try and turn course on. But when they see something that they actually do really need, you have that iPhone effect. The game is really different. Mm-hmm. So some of the companies that have successfully worked in this space where they haven't created a product, shown it to defense, and defense has said, great, now bespoke it for me. You know, and it's pulled them off their pathway, off their development plan. Like, when defense has seen something that is a good fit, right? Like, the level of support, the speed of movement has been really different. And there's some, like, public examples of this where companies have worked with the services very early on and had quite a bit of non-dilutive funding, but the real benefit they get is, like, this amazing reference customer who's
and
a
testing
genuine
environment, right? Yeah.
Problem. It's quite tolerant of risk because they have no solution, right? So, like, a 60-70% solution, even if it's as high as that, it's better than nothing.
Yeah.
And a really motivated team, because often the people in defense are really motivated to try and solve this problem. Like, it's their daily problem.
Yeah.
So there is a great issue, there is a problem in the system with people finding defense hard to work with, but often that issue arises when the fit isn't exact, when somebody is trying to sell to defense. Mm-hmm. When you find the right thing, defense pulls it in,
yeah,
and
it
becomes much, much easier. And so I think that's really hard to find when you don't come from those worlds, right? Like, defense is quite a closed world. It's not easy to navigate. Like, you still can't go onto the internet and find the global address list, right? That is on its own, like, proprietary system. So you need somebody who can effectively impart, be a translator,
yeah.
Who can be an interface. Like, some of this exists in the US. Like, the concept of dual use has been around for slightly longer, but it's also, like, a slightly harder edged thing. It exists now in the UK, and that's the space that we're in. I think also to your earlier point around some of this, I also find it quite an intersectional space. So for me, some of the companies I'm interested in, the other VCs, the other angels are interested in, for example, sustainability. I'm interested in it because it reduces energy, it brings the cost down, it becomes something you can do in the UK. It's, you know, we want the same kind of thing for the company for very different reasons. Mm. But that, I think, gives you some healthy tension in the advice. It gives different customer base support. You know, it's a really interesting space to be in when it's not two or three climate funds.
Yeah.
When it's like a climate fund and a defense linked fund, you get something quite different.
Because your thought processes and the outcomes are different. And I think what's really interesting in my mind, and I think this is why,
and your networks are really different.
Well, precisely, yeah. Right? So what I was going to say was, like, you know, most founders that I would speak to, like, they're not thinking about defense. Like, 99% of founders are not thinking about defense. They're thinking about B2B or consumer, right? But their you know, but their technology may have some application, like thinking about AI, thinking about impossible. What was the business? I can't remember now. You know, that spend a lot of time trying to create virtual worlds for kind of scenario planning and so on. You know, you maybe they started off as gaming environments, but actually have incredible applications within. But so it is about someone actually being able to kind of look at it and say, oh, that could have application here, right?
Yeah, gaming and scenario, you know, simulation in the military is a great one. Materials is interesting. Anything to do with energy is interesting. You know, like AI, obviously, but I think AI is, I mean, I had somebody say today, it's like electricity, right? Like a slightly different thing. But yeah, I think that's the point. This isn't about, you know, trying to get VCs to fund weapons. This is about technologies that can go to different customer bases. And I think that founders are waking up, I think, you know, not to be pejorative here, but sort of thinking differently maybe is a fairer way of describing it. A few years ago, 5-6 years ago, when I got into the space, you would often have a founder say, look, ethically, I'm not like comfortable with my technology being used in that way. And I think it's because when you say defense, people hear attack. I think that maybe that's understandable when you look back at the last couple of decades. But if you look at what's happening in the world today, a lot of founders are saying, like, actually, I think we could play a role here and we could do something positive. How can I engage in the system? How can I help? You know, I'm no longer having to go into very early stage companies and say to people like, okay, this is actually how we really work. And I think it helps. I don't look necessarily how people expect, right? Like I don't turn up with a big beard and a gun and like, you know, a Rottweiler. Somebody's mum turns up and they're like, oh, like, it kind of brings the reality that the military is a group of actual people.
Yeah.
It's not like a kind of...
How many people are in the military in the UK today?
Oh, I mean, I would struggle to put a number on that, I think, depending on if you included things like reserves and so on. But actually, it's a surprisingly small number. You know, the Air Force is something like 40,000 people now.
Wow.
And I think that number is getting smaller.
Yeah.
You know, the trend is downwards.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, leading from that exact point, I mean, you know, a lot of people, I would assume, would think that investing in defense technology is net negative precisely because they think along the lines of, well, it must be being used for, you know, militaristic purposes and so on and so forth. But from an ethical perspective, you can argue exactly the opposite, exactly as you say, right? It's required to maintain security, national security, rule of law, and democracy at fundamentally, right? Democracy cannot exist without that rule of law. It's kind of you need the safe space in which to in which democracy can flourish, right? So that's how you avoid dystopian outcomes. And we know, you know, authoritarian regimes turn the military inwards and, you know, destroy democracy by using them as a tool to essentially, I guess, control the individuals and populations.
Scenario,
and your whole 1984, which we won't go too far into that because who knows how close to that we are. But anyway, how do you make that case? Like, how is it that you, how can you actually go out to either founders or investors or LPs and just make the case that no, this is for the greater good. It isn't just about funding wars or military activity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that's super personal to me. Like, one, I just, you know, why take the pain and grief of being a new manager setting up a fund in the UK, right? Like, why not just go and work at a deep tech fund? This is kind of the core of it for me. It's because I think there's an element of stewardship to this. You know, some of the technologies, like personally, I really don't like eVTOL. Like, I have an ethical issue with eVTOL and a couple other technologies like it because I think they actually
Can you explain what that is?
What the technology is or what the issue is.
Both, yeah.
Oh, okay, so like a sort of drone cross with a helicopter.
Okay,
right?
Got it.
Like a kind of often pitched as a sort of mobility opportunity for the future that will revolutionise how people are able to travel around cities.
Got it.
The reason I don't like it is that those need a like takeoff and landing point, right? So you should think about it, maybe the framework I like is like a luxury tube. You have to go to a terminus to get on and you're going to go to a terminus to get off. Who's going to be able to afford that? Well, it's not going to replace my tube journey, right?
Sure.
It's probably not going to replace the majority of people's tube journeys. Do I want to live in a world where something like that is flying over my head all the time? Like, not really.
Probably not.
No. Like, I think we've all been at like a wedding or an event or something where there's a drone flying around and you just can't help but look at it. And also, I think a lot of people have this natural instinct of like a big insect. You kind of want to swat it out of the sky.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to give a very limited number of people or even,
you know, I guess there will be a number of people that wonder whether it is benign or whether it is some sort of aggressive.
What's on there? Yeah, what sensors are on there? So I think for me, something like that, you can look forward into the future and say, okay, fine, this is attracting a lot of funding right now, but what does the world look like with that in it? Is it net positive, net negative? Mm. Right. For me, my calculations come out net negative. Like, I don't think we really need that. although I was recently in the traffic in LA and I can understand why you like sit in that and think, oh my God, what could I do to get out of this? But I think there's a really important role here for thinking through the reality of how something like this might get used in the military context. I think that's really hard to do unless you've been in the system or you've been very close to it, for example, like a civil servant inside defence. Mm-hmm. So there isn't a large number of people with that experience, right? And I personally feel that that's one aspect of my experience that's quite important here in how I downselect companies. Like, is this going to be a net positive thing? My view of the role of defence is defensive, right? It's not necessarily unarmed. There is an aspect where the two can't be.
Yeah, you can't have soldiers without weapons. I'm like, right. It would be kind of pointless. Yeah.
Right, it's pointless. But the purpose of that is a defensive purpose, right? And I think we're seeing some of this in the Ukraine, okay? Like around, you can't meet something like the invasion of the Ukraine in a peaceful diplomatic way. Like, you're not going to have the leverage you need to resolve that. There needs to be a balance in that discussion before you can bring both parties to the table for meaningful concessions, right? So I think a lot of this is around the down selection, around the real likelihood how these things are going to get used and their real impact, not only in defence and security, but like in the world, right? Like that to me is a big part of my personal rationale for wanting to be like in the driving seat here, right? Like, not only in terms of picking and down selecting, but literally having the vote on the investment committee. I don't think I could handle being in an environment where I've got the experience to understand how these things would end up or could end up and having to support that without any like skin in the game.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the questions that kind of came to my mind there was, in the same way that you spent 18 years in the Royal Air Force before setting up, you know, the CVC, the corporate venture fund within the Air Force, and now obviously Twin Track. I mean, do people within the military, are there people coming through the military with the sort of mindset where they're thinking, okay, I want to understand how this works so that I can then go and do what you're doing, for example, or even innovate in the space or whatever. And is there a pathway for them? I mean, like, is the military actively encouraging that thinking, or is it?
Yeah, still? I mean, there is. So in terms of pathway, different services have a different approach. They have a like kind of internal accelerator. Mm-hmm. My personal concern is that you need to be careful you don't accelerate people out of the military, like give people out of the military.
Yeah, so train them and then they go off and do their own thing. Yeah.
So I think, you know, the other half of this is around the financing. So that's quickly what I sort of felt when I was inside and why I felt it was important to have a CVC, because a lot of it was how quickly could you finance something? You know, how are you making the decision on supporting something? That isn't there. That is very different between different armed forces, between the UK, America, other kind of allied countries. So I think there's quite a lot of work to be done on like the idea of risk. So the armed forces always says it's a risk-taking organisation. And when you're in a war zone, it is. But when you come to sort of working on something like innovation at home, it isn't. Like, there is a kind of genuine fear, I think, is not too strong a word, around like taking money, spending it, and the tech not working. And of course, that's really... failure is really an inherent important part of innovation. So culturally, I think that's work in progress rather than something that hasn't started. I think there are more people who are inside the military who are saying, actually, I'm going to be a founder. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting in terms of like a different mindset and people on both sides of the table having experience and language to understand, you know, the connections. It's not a great source of deal flow for me because I find a lot of people are producing stuff that is not deep tech. And therefore, I think you need... like a range of funds and a range of voices here. And it's a, you know, a space that will mature as fast as the conditions for new managers in the UK allows it to mature, right? Like, if those conditions are better in the future, there'll be more of them.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, this is such a kind of, I guess, left field environment for me, right? Like, military and defense is not something that I've actively been involved in. You know, to your earlier point, like, not everyone goes into the military. There is no national service. You don't have that close tie. And we had the CCF at the school that I was at, but I didn't. I wasn't in the cadet forces. I did, you know, volunteering or whatever it was that I did whenever I did turn up on a Friday afternoon. but I think it. I think there is a need, and this is one of the things that, you know, I said I'd argued with my daughters, because I actually think national service is. There is a positive benefit for that. I think that the negative, and certainly the issue that I think a lot of kids would see, is, well, you can't force me to do it. I don't want to do it. And I agree with that, but there has to be sort of an avenue whereby people can get that exposure and understanding so that, you know, so that they do have that kind of greater good in mind and understand how the pieces fit together and why it's important, right? So yes, for my daughters, I would hope that they would never have to see the military in action, right? But that doesn't preclude them from understanding why it's important that the military exists and how they might be able to support or assist that in different ways. Moving on, it would be great if you could talk me through what the ITAR exemptions are, which is the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, and the impact that that has on businesses in the UK and Europe, and why it's going to be hard to justify establishing a business in geographical Europe outside of the UK if you want to sell to the US. What is that?
Sure.
Interplay?
I mean, this is a massive change. I think there's a branding issue, right, first of all, because it doesn't sound great to be talking about, like, trafficking in arms.
Yeah.
But so the UK, the Australians, and the US have come together under
the AUKUS
pact. Yeah. So the core idea is about peace and security in the Pacific and working as a very close partnership. So there is a range of structures inside, but something known as Pillar 2 is around emerging technologies and how those three nations, four if others join, I think Japan is quite keen on potentially joining that and broadening the group, how those three to four nations can really work together and really have a very strong technical relationship on emerging technologies. So what I mean by that is it includes things like artificial intelligence, hypersonics, quite a broad range of stuff from software through to hardware. So it's really difficult to deal with some of the regulations because correctly there is a lot of regulation in place. The issue here is around making it easier for companies in the UK and Australia to engage with the US Department of Defense. So it strips out some of that repetitive regulation that can take a really long, like years to deal with. And so why is that significant? Well, it's super significant for companies in the UK and Australia working in the dual use space where the DoD is potentially a very large customer. The American market is potentially very significant because the military actually has like a community aspect to it, right? Like if you're working with defense in the UK, that is a great example to share with the defense and security community in Australia, defense and security community in America. But if it takes 2 years to get you through the sales process, like that's not great.
You might be dead.
Right? So in terms of what that means for UK-based companies, Australian-based companies, it's like an edge. It's like improved access to a very large market, a very large defense market, and one we're really, really close to, right, where there are real active issues and real problem sets to work on. So in terms of the you know, as you described earlier, the growing number of founders that are potentially interested in this space, like if you're here and you're setting up a company in the UK, you're in Australia and you're setting up a company in Australia, like that's
a
big edge, It's a really significant change. It's good news for the dual use ecosystem.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the question then arises, okay, if you have founders within mainland Europe or within the wider European geography who are building this sort of technology, does that then mean that for them it would be better if they headquartered in the UK or Australia for that matter? Or does it just mean that their pathway to accessing that kind of US ecosystem is much slower or potentially denied altogether?
So at the moment it's a proposed change. We're waiting to see what happens with the detail. I think the answer won't be that it's denied altogether.
Sure.
I think this is about speed, and I think in startups
that
speed is super important, right?
Yeah.
So I think what it means is if you're here in the UK, you get an advantage and you get a big advantage because of the size of the market over there. Mm. So I think there's a lot to still be worked through on the detail, but this is like a really big and significant change. I think a good sign of the government's working quite carefully with each other to try and really unblock some of the barriers, right? It's not all about trying to train people inside the military to be more innovative. You know, some of this is how they connect to the growing system outside, right? Like, I don't think this is about repeating it internally. This is about removing some of the barrier to entry for people doing this as a business.
Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense. And look, I think, you know, the UK has always played a significant role in this environment and has always been a bridge, I guess, to some extent between Europe and the US in any case. We have London certainly has long been, you know, outside of the US, one of the main, regions for innovations and innovation and venture kind of funding and growth. And so, I'm always an advocate for the more we do here, the better it becomes. And actually, yes, we should be attracting as many companies, as many founders as possible to set up shop here, because, you know, if they have the opportunity, that brings so much net positive again, not just within the context of what we're talking about, defense and military, but also just generally, you know, for the country, for jobs, right, for everything else that kind of flows from there. So look, finally, what is one thing that you have a really contrarian conviction about from any kind of area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or even at home? What is a hill that you would die on defending?
Well, I've got a few, right? Like, I mean, maybe that's sort of the bread and butter of VCs, but one I'll share that's quite specifically like related to this is actually like, I think we've reached peak drone is my personal view.
Okay.
So TwinTrack likes hardware, but this is an area where the thesis like inverts. So I think that we're going to see like a real change in what's happening in the drone space, specifically in the drone hardware space. So I see lots of people rushing into it, investing a lot in it, but I feel like for us and for me and my view is quite contrarian.
That's really annoying because we were about to start working with a drone startup. I was going to send it your way. No, I'm only semi-joking, if I'm honest. Yeah. But Nicola, thank you so much. It's been absolutely wonderful having you on the podcast today. I'm not entirely sure, you know, whether everyone would agree with you on the peak drone question. Although, I mean, it's certainly something that we're hearing less of, I guess, these days. And maybe that's because, you know, all the excitement has sort of somewhat died down. But in the meantime, for our audience and our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you online? You're on LinkedIn, are you on Twitter? Where can they find you?
Yeah, for my sins, I'm on LinkedIn.
Okay, amazing. Nicola Sinclair on LinkedIn. Thank you so much for joining me today in the studio. It's been an absolute blast.
Thanks, Harish. It's been fun.